You know, I knew going into this weekend, 4th of July weekend, that typically 4th of July weekends, people travel. So I was kind of expecting that there was going to be less people here today. But you guys showed up. This is awesome. You guys showed up. I'm honored to be speaking today about Cain and Abel. Let me start here. Genesis and Gene share the same Greek root, gen, which means birth or origin. And I think what's interesting is that just as our lives unfold from our genetic code, so the Bible unfolds from Genesis. It is in many ways the genetic code of human history. Ecclesiastes 1:9 says that what has been will be again, what has been done will be done again, and there is nothing new under the sun. So just like there is nothing new under the sun, there is nothing new after the first few chapters of Genesis. And so what we get in Genesis is the creation. We also have the fall. And then in Genesis 4, shooting out of that story at the beginning of the Bible, is a story of Cain and Abel. And it kind of hits you really hard when you're reading. You're going through the chapters, you're going through the beginning, and then all of a sudden this very different story happens where a brother kills a brother. And so we're going to unpack that today. After the fall in Genesis 3, when God drove Adam and Eve out of the garden, Genesis 4 picks up here. Let's read. Adam made love to his wife Eve, and she became pregnant and gave birth to Cain. She said, "With the help of the Lord, I have brought forth a man." Later, she gave birth to his brother Abel. Now Abel kept flocks, and Cain worked the soil. In the course of time, Cain brought some of the fruits of the soil as an offering to the Lord. And Abel also brought an offering, fat portions from some of the firstborn of his flock. The Lord looked with favor on Abel and his offering, but on Cain and his offering, he did not look with favor. So Cain was very angry, and his face was downcast. Then the Lord said to Cain, "Why are you angry? Why is your face downcast? If you do what is right, will you not be accepted? But if you do not do what is right, sin is crouching at your door. It desires to have you, but you must rule over it." Now Cain said to his brother Abel, "Let's go out to the field." While they were in the field, Cain attacked his brother Abel and killed him. Then the Lord said to Cain, "Where is your brother Abel?" "I don't know," Cain replied. "Am I my brother's keeper?" Then the Lord said, "What have you done? Listen, your brother's blood cries out to me from the ground, which opened its mouth to receive your brother's blood from your hand. When you work the ground, it will no longer yield its crops for you. You will be a restless wanderer on the earth." Cain said to the Lord, "My punishment is more than I can bear. Today you are driving me from the land, and I will be hidden from your presence. I will be a restless wanderer on the earth, and whoever finds me will kill me." But the Lord said to Cain, "Not so. Anyone who kills Cain will suffer vengeance seven times over." Then the Lord put a mark on Cain so that no one who found him will kill him. So Cain went out from the Lord's presence and lived in the land of Nod, east of Eden. Now there's a lot to unpack in this scripture, but I'll summarize the content into three parts. I think what we learn here and what God is teaching us here through Cain and Abel is the severity of sin, the sweetness of God, and the significance of sacrifice. So let's just look at them in order. Let's go right in. The severity of sin. Genesis 4:7, I think, is one of the most vivid verses in the Bible, because God reveals the nature of sin to Cain in a metaphor. He says, "If you do not do what is right, sin is crouching at your door. It desires to have you, but you must rule over it." So what is the nature of sin? Sin is crouching at your door, at our door, and it desires to have us. It is hidden and it is powerful. Now, when I was 10 years old, I had a dog named Caden. He's a husky lab. And one of my first memorable experiences with Caden was that I was in the backyard with him and a deer came through the trees. Caden was a young puppy at this time, and when he saw the deer, he got into this mode where he started sinking low to the ground. You know, you probably, if you have a dog or if you have a cat, you probably know what I'm talking about. That imagery of Caden sinking real low. He was motionless. He was invisible. He almost snuck behind me to be a little bit more hidden. And I think this is how we should interpret the word crouching here. As used in this context in the Hebrew, the word often refers to the movement of leopards or tigers when those predators see their prey. They crouch down, they get out of view. And that's what God teaches Cain and us here, that it is the nature of sin to hide itself, that sin crouches, it gets out of view. Sin insists that it is much smaller and much less present than we think it is. You know, it says, don't mind me, I'll just be over here in the corner. I won't bother you, I'm just sitting here. But sin is never sitting in a corner. Sin is crouching in the corner or at the door, and it is waiting to pounce, waiting to spring, and waiting to take over our entire lives. Because Caden didn't just crouch behind me motionless, right? When the deer sensed that Caden was there, the deer ran. And so I'll paint this picture for you where the backyards of my old house were all connected. I lived on a drive, and there was sort of this inner circle, and none of those houses had backyards. So the way that the deer ran was about a 100-yard stretch toward the main road. And I'm 10 years old at the time. I know I look pretty big right now, but I wasn't always this size. I used to be pretty small. And when Caden saw the deer running toward the main road, he pounced because Caden wanted to catch the deer. Now, Caden, we didn't have a fence or an invisible fence, so what we did was we chained him to our porch. And he pounced with such force that the chain broke. And it was a long enough chain that I was able to grab it, but I was so small and I was so weak that I ended up running with him. I was like chasing after him like this, you know, just running along. And eventually he was pulling so hard that he sent me into the air. Like I dove, and if only for a moment, I was horizontal to the ground, just going like this, flying in midair. It was one of those moments, it was like slow motion movie. You know, I'm falling to the ground. I know I'm about to slam into it, and boom, I slam into the ground. I fumble the cord, and Caden ends up chasing this deer around the whole neighborhood, and it's my responsibility to go find him and catch him. And it happened a lot. Caden was a dog that ran away no matter how much we gave him, no matter how great a life we gave him. Whenever he had the opportunity, he would run away. It's one of those dogs. But sin is like a leopard or a tiger or Caden when he sees a deer. It pounces powerfully. And that's it. Sin is hidden and it is powerful. Sin will crouch and it will pounce and it will take over our entire lives. And that's what God is communicating to Cain here. But how does sin take over our lives? I want to look at a few ways, a couple of small ways, though they're not small, they are very big. And the first of which are that sin hides and hoards. When you look at 2 Corinthians 4:4, it says, the God of this age has blinded the minds of unbelievers so that they cannot see the light of the gospel that displays the glory of Christ, who is the image of God. And so if we can be blinded to something as magnificent as Jesus's glory, I'm sure we can be blinded to a sin that is crouching in the corner, waiting to have us. In his devotional New Morning Mercies, Paul David Tripp writes this of spiritual blindness, of the ways that sin can hide from us in our lives. He says, you and I like to think that no one has a clearer, more accurate view of us than we do. We all tend to be way too trusting of our view of ourselves. And if sin is deceitful, and it is, if sin blinds, and it does, then as long as sin still lurks inside me or crouches around me, you could say, there will be patches of spiritual blindness. I simply will not see myself with the accuracy that I think I do. Not only does sin blind, but as sinners, we participate in our own blindness. We all swindle ourselves into thinking that we are better than we are. Tripp writes that we can test our spiritual blindness by examining a few things. He calls these masquerades, calls them masquerades in a costume kingdom, that you would put something over what would maybe be sin in your life and masking it with something that seems good. And so he asks a series of questions. I think they'll be up on the screen, but I'll read them as this. Here's the first one. There's a few. Does a focus on material things masquerade as good stewardship of your possessions? Does loving personal control masquerade as using God-given leadership? Does anger masquerade as having a heart for what is right? Does self-righteous legalism masquerade as loving God's law? Does building your own ministry empire masquerade as a commitment to the expansion of God's kingdom? Does fear of man masquerade as a sensitive heart toward the needs of others? Does selfish attention-seeking masquerade as being candid about your needs? Does craving to be known or to be respected masquerade as a commitment to ministry? Does bondage to the opinion of others masquerade as a commitment to community? Does lust masquerade as a celebration of the beauty of God's creation? Does gossip masquerade as a prayerful concern for others? And then Tripp writes this: the masquerading nature of sin plays to the fickleness of our idolatrous hearts. Let me take a beat, drink some water, give you a chance to read over those. Now, I think it is scary to imagine the number of times that we think we are serving God when we are actually serving ourselves. I think it is scary to think of the number of times we believe we are worshiping God when we are actually worshiping to and servicing to some aspect of creation. But that's what sin does. It hides and it hoards. Sin is crouching at our door and it desires to have us, and not just part of us, but all of us. It never wants to stay in the corner. In the fickleness of our idolatrous hearts, as Tripp says, is that if we sin once, if we masquerade once, if we put on a costume once, it becomes a heck of a lot easier to do it again and again and again and again. It is almost like we are taking a knife and stabbing our will through the heart. It's like we're taking a hammer and breaking through a piece of glass, because once you do it, it becomes easier to do again and again. And that is the hoarding nature of sin, is that it's hiding from us, but then once it has us, it wants to have us again and again and again. And now some of us could think, you know, I never masquerade. I'm an open book. I never wear costumes. But my hope is that as you hear these things, you don't think, you know, I wish my son or my daughter were here. I wish my mom or my dad were here. I wish my friend or my coworker were here. Because sin has more than one strategy to take over our lives. It does. In fact, it has several, has way more than what I can get into today. And I wish I had more time to unpack all of them, but I'll stick to two more. I will say, for those who are interested in learning more about sin strategies, I found this book. It's Thomas Brooks's Precious Remedies Against Satan's Devices. It's a great book. It was written in the 1600s. It's on Amazon, and the front cover just has the title and the author name, and then the back cover is just a white blank page. So that's how you know it's a good book, I think, but I digress. You know, sin hides and it hoards. Sin can also make us fantasize and overgeneralize. So what do I mean by that? To overgeneralize is this: that we assume an experience from one event will apply to other events. Take a grudge, for example. You cannot maintain a grudge against someone without feeling superior to them. And you will overgeneralize. If you feel superior to somebody enough to stay mad at them, you will feel superior to others too. If you are a man and you hold a grudge against a woman, that will overgeneralize and it will impact how you view all women. If you are a man and you hold a grudge against a woman, that will overgeneralize and it will impact how you view men. Now, if you are in a dating relationship or a marital relationship and that person hurts you in that relationship, those feelings can overgeneralize and it ends up affecting the way that you view dating and marriage. If you hold a grudge against someone of a different race, religion, sexual orientation, political party, whatever it is, it will overgeneralize and you will think ill of the entire group. Sin will never, ever sit in the corner. It doesn't do it with fantasies either. Some of us spend a lot of our time fantasizing about how our lives really should be going. We fantasize about career success. We fantasize about material conditions. We fantasize about how if this were to happen or if that were to happen, then my life would be so much better. You see, sin is never in the corner, just waiting and sitting. It is ready to attack. It is ready to spring. It's whispering. When we fantasize, it's whispering, you know, I'm just a release valve. There's nothing wrong with visualizing your future, visualizing success for yourself. But it is crouching over there in the corner, waiting to take your life over. Because fantasizing poisons your life. You know, you are unable to appreciate what you have now. You are either living in the past or living in the future, but never in the present. And you're out of sorts. Most often, unfortunately, too, our antidotes to that poison, when fantasizing poisons our life, is to run to things like addiction and obsession. And that is very true of our culture today. The running to alcoholism, workaholism, some new diet, some new workout routine, some new self-help podcast. It doesn't matter. We think that if we look a little different, work a little harder, make a little bit more money, then I'll be better. But that's sin at work. We become like Sisyphus, endlessly rolling this boulder uphill, trapped on the hamster wheel, running around in circles, trying to be somebody that we're not, trying to accomplish something that we can't. Because once you get the next thing, you're gonna be running for another. And it is just a race to continue finding the next best thing. Sin will never, ever sit and stay in a corner. It is crouching and it is waiting to pounce and take over our entire lives. And that's the reason that we shouldn't play around with it. That's the reason we shouldn't be casual about it. And that's the reason God came to Cain before Cain killed Abel. Which gets us to the second point, and that is the sweetness of God. If we look at how God treats Cain in Genesis 4, we see sweetness and tenderness. It is unbelievable. What we see is God as a wonderful counselor, not a cosmic cop. God intervenes early. In verse 6, before Cain committed the bad deed, God comes to him and asks, "Why are you angry? Why is your face downcast?" The moment Cain feels depressed, God comes to him like a wonderful counselor. He is not somewhere else with his arms crossed, you know, tapping his foot, you know, waiting to see, is Cain going to come through? God comes to him. God intervenes early, but he also intervenes tenderly. When he comes to Cain, he doesn't scream or shout. You know, he's not going like, "How dare you question the way that I view offerings? Don't you know who I am? Grovel before me." You know, God's not yelling these things. He's not coming in with demands or statements. He's coming in with questions. He asks, "Why are you angry? Why is your face downcast?" And this is before God even gets to the idea of what's right. He tells Cain, "I want you to get underneath. I want you to look at the motives for why you are angry and downcast. I want you to get behind it. I want you to understand it." God is a wonderful counselor. Again, he approaches with questions rather than commands and directions. And he does eventually tell Cain to get to the right thing. I think it's important that we point that out. But he doesn't just say to do the right thing. He says, "I want you to understand, Cain, what's making your heart tick. I want you to understand what's happening here, what's going on. And unfortunately, despite God's counseling, sin had Cain. Or as 1 John 3:12 says, Cain belonged to the evil one and murdered his brother. Sin had come from the corner. It was crouching there. It had pounced. It had Cain. Cain committed the action of killing Abel. But what happens here is that even through that, even after God came to Cain and counseled him, even after Cain killed his brother, God comes to Cain again with a sweetness that Cain can't comprehend. And many of us, I think in my study of this too, it was hard for me to comprehend the way that God comes to Cain with such tenderness and sweetness. Now let's look back to Genesis 4, verses 9 through 15. It says this, that the Lord came to Cain and asks, "Where is your brother Abel?" And Cain replies, "I don't know. Am I my brother's keeper?" And that very question is something that has stuck with me for the weeks of coming up and preparing for this sermon, because the question Cain asks is exactly what he was supposed to be. He was supposed to be his brother's keeper. Instead, he was his brother's murderer. And God, knowing that, still approaches Cain with this word, these instructions. He says to Cain, "What have you done? Your brother's blood cries out to me from the ground. Now you are under a curse and driven from the ground, which opened its mouth to receive your brother's blood from your hand. When you work the ground, it will no longer yield its crops for you. You will be a restless wanderer on the earth." And Cain responds, "My punishment is more than I can bear. Today you are driving me from the land. I will be hidden from your presence. I will be a restless wanderer, and whoever finds me will kill me." But the Lord says to Cain, "Not so. Anyone who kills Cain will suffer vengeance seven times over." And this is incredible. I love this. Derek Kidner, a 20th century theologian, he's an author of numerous Bible commentaries, many of which I used to help me form this sermon. He writes this about God's final intervention with Cain. He says, "God's concern for justice for the innocent, that in this story being Abel, is matched by one other thing, his care for the sinner. Even the querulous prayer of Cain had contained a germ of an appeal. God answered his pledge together with this marker sign, not a stigma, but safe conduct, which makes God virtually Cain's goel or protector. It is the most mercy can do for the unrepentant." And this tells us so much, that God is not only just concerned for the innocent, but he is also concerned for the unrepentant, that he is merciful to the unrepentant. And that's what Cain is here. Because the mark of a repentant person is that they are more concerned with the sin than they are with the punishment. A repentant person says, "My punishment is just." An unrepentant person says, "My punishment is more than I deserve." And that's Cain here, who belongs in that latter category, because as soon as God delivers his instructions to Cain and says what will happen to Cain, Cain says, "This isn't fair, this isn't right, this isn't just." And God responds in a way, allow me to lean on Kidner again, who says this, "In Cain's ridiculous, unrepentant, self-defensive plea, there is a cry from Cain, albeit small, for please pity me." And God responds. He responds with justice and mercy. And this is something that a lot of us tend not to do. We tend not to combine God's justice and mercy and the two of those things working together at the same time. We think of God's justice, his mercy, and his grace, and those three things may be working together as different parts of God's interactions with us and interactions with parts or characters and people in the Bible. But what God is doing here is he is combining his justice and his mercy. He is saying to Cain, "I must tell you, Cain, I must tell you that what you have done is wrong. We cannot be intimate. But I am not disciplining you out of ill will. I will protect you because I want you to repent. I want to be intimate with you. And you see, the Cains in life, and you know, here I am like overgeneralizing and categorizing, but I think this will paint a decent picture for what I'm about to describe, is that there may be Cains in life who never want us to combine God's justice and his mercy. Cains will come to us and say, accept me completely or reject me completely. And we're tempted to do that. You either accept someone completely or else you are hostile and you are sending them out. The relationship is broken. And Cains hate the idea of you saying to them, you are doing wrong, but I love you. They say, you don't love me. If you love me, you would accept what I'm doing and who I am. They'll make it very, very hard. And this is one of the greatest challenges of being a Christian, I think, is to tell someone that what they are doing is wrong, yet you bear them no ill will. You care for them. You love them. You want to protect them. You are genuinely interested in their best interests. Because when that happens, when we look at how God treats Cain here and we treat the Cains of our lives the same way, it is a beautiful, beautiful thing. And I'll add this, one last thing in this section is that if God treats Cain with the sweetness and the tenderness that he does here, he will treat us in the same way when we approach him. Whether we struggle with masquerading, whether we struggle with putting on costumes, or if we overgeneralize, or if we fantasize, or if whatever it is, whatever the sin is in our life, if we come to him with a repentant heart, I think that we are in step, maybe even ahead of Cain here. Now let's get into the significance of sacrifice. Do you know the difference between Cain and Abel's offerings? Genesis 4 doesn't tell us much, does it? But if we look at Hebrews 11, we look at the hall of faith, as some may call it, we see in verse 4, it says this, by faith, Abel brought God a better offering than Cain did. By faith, he was commended as righteous when God spoke well of his offerings. So Abel offered in faith when Cain did not, is what I get from Hebrews 11:4. Well, and that makes perfect sense. You know, here's what happened. Abel offered in faith, which, as Tim Keller once said, in the Bible, faith always is a response to God's grace. So Abel did that. He responded to God's grace in faith, but Cain did not. And stay with me for a second. If we go back into Genesis 3, Genesis 3:15, after the serpent had tricked Adam and Eve to eat the forbidden fruit, God tells the serpent that from Adam and Eve will come a man who will crush his head, even though the serpent will strike his heel. And this was as much a threat to the serpent as it was a promise to Adam and Eve. Adam and Eve, I'm confident, I'm hopeful that when they left the garden, when God drove them out, that they remembered this promise that God had given to them, that from them would come someone, their Redeemer. There would come someone who would make their relationship with God as it was once again. So then I'm also hopeful that Adam and Eve would have shared that promise with Cain and Abel, their sons. And I'm hopeful and I'm confident in this, that Abel's response was one of he was responding in a way that he had faith in the promise that God had given Adam and Eve, that someday some descendant of Adam and Eve would arrive and not just hate sin, but wrestle with sin and hate death as well, wrestle with death, that even though that he would be wounded, he would triumph and defeat sin and death. Abel's sacrifice was a response to salvation, to a promise of salvation. But what of Cain's sacrifice? So what's Cain's sacrifice if that's Abel's? I think Cain's sacrifice was not a response to salvation, but a means of salvation. It's the only explanation I can think of for Cain's response, for when God did not look on his sacrifice with favor, that Cain would have been so upset, that he would have been so downcast and depressed and frustrated. was that Cain must have gone before God in a different way than Abel, saying, look at what I've done, Lord. Look at what I've accomplished. Look at my sacrifices. Look at my goodness. But God does not look on him with favor, and this upsets Cain. And we have to think of Cain, too, as an elder brother. An elder brother in the story of the prodigal son that we spent so much time unpacking earlier this year. He's just like the elder brother that Cain tried to earn God's favor, but Abel responded to God's grace. Now, this leaves us with a couple of questions for us all to consider. The first one being, are we more in our lives like Cain trying to earn God's favor, or are we more like Abel responding to God's grace in the actions that we do? And the second question is this, how do we become more like Abel? The sweet, loving Abel who brought forth the best of his sacrifices to the Lord as a response to his salvation, a promise of future salvation. Now, I can't answer the first for you. That's something you'll have to answer for yourselves, but I can answer the second for us. And the way that we become more like Abel is we look at the true and better Abel, and that is Jesus. There was a video Takasha showed before her sermon on the thief on the cross. It was the true and better video. And within it, the person creating the video is pointing to characters throughout the Old Testament that Jesus is the true and better version of, that he is the true and better Adam and Eve. He is the true and better Cain and Abel. He is the true and better Abraham and Isaac. He is the true and better, the list goes on. Because the Bible is not a series of disconnected stories. It is so important to remember that. It is a single narrative in which every story and every character points beyond itself to one who is greater. So like Abel, Jesus was full of grace and faith. Like Abel, Jesus was killed by Cain's. And don't forget that Cain was a religious person. He was a good person, a moral person who tried to earn God's favor with his good deeds. The people who killed Jesus were not the irreligious. They were not the immoral people, the tax collectors like Zacchaeus. They didn't kill him. It was the religious and the moral people who killed Jesus, those who were trying to earn God's favor rather than responding to his grace. And there is another way that Jesus is the true and better Abel. Abel's blood called out for justice for himself. Jesus' blood spilled on the cross, calls out for justice for us. It says in Hebrews 12 that Jesus's blood speaks a better word than Abel's and allows us to access God's dwelling place on Mount Zion. Let me look at Hebrews 12, if you want to look with me there as well. It says this in verses 18 through 23, that without Jesus's blood, you will come to a mountain that can be touched and that is burning with fire, to darkness, gloom, and storm, to a trumpet blast, or to such a voice speaking words that those who heard it begged that no further word be spoken to them. But because of Jesus' blood, because of his sacrifice, his offering, we can go to Mount Zion, the city of the living God, the heavenly Jerusalem. You can come to thousands upon thousands of angels singing in joyful assembly in the church of the firstborn whose names are written in heaven. You can come to God, the judge of all, to the spirits of the righteous made perfect. And here's the beautiful part, to Jesus, the mediator of a new covenant, and to the sprinkled blood that speaks a better word than the blood of Abel. When we sin, if we are Christian, if we believe in the sacrifice that Jesus has made for us, Jesus is standing before the Father, the judge of all, and he is pointing to himself and saying, Father, I want them acquitted. I want them to be loved. Your law demands payment, and I have given it. It was our agreement that you would send me to take their place, to die for them. I have paid the debt. My blood cries out, not for justice against, or not, it cries out for justice, not against them, but for them. His blood cries out for justice, not against us, but for us. Jesus is the true and better Abel. For Abel, one lamb atoned for a man. At Passover, one lamb atoned for a family. And on the cross, one lamb atoned for the whole world. Finally, with Jesus, there was one lamb who took away the sin of the world. That's what John the Baptist said last week, right, Pastor John? John 1:29, behold, the Lamb of God who takes away the sin of the world. We follow him. If we are to become more like him, we look to that cross and we remember what he accomplished for us on it. And we can live a life that is a response to that salvation rather than living in this life of chasing and sprinting and trying to make our way, earning his favor. So my prayer for this church today is that we would respond to his grace, that we would respond to his salvation. So let's do that together, church, and worship.